Welcome to Empire History Podcast, Erdo Achilles Part 4, Darkest Before the Dawn. Last time, we enjoyed the topsy-turvy life of Perdiccas II as he tried to weather succession challenges from day one of his reign, facing encroachment from Athens, a Thracian invasion, and the ups and downs of the Peloponnesian War. He ruled for an amazing 41 years, and upon his death in 413, his son Archelaus took the throne. Archelaus's reign takes place in the eye of the storm. It's a brief period of calm before the storm supercharges a decline of Macedonian power. He passes in 399 BC violently and kicked off a succession chase that lasted until 359. Now, I had mentioned last episode that Archelaus took power peacefully, without the same challenges to succession his father faced. It would be nice to think that his father Perdiccas had enough legitimacy to secure his successor's path, but when reading the ancient sources, we're presented with an alternate history. This history states that Archelaus was actually the bastard son of Perdiccas II, who had him with his brother Alcetus' slave girl, Robert Baratheon, anyone? The throne then was supposed to go to one of Alexander I's other sons. In this scenario, Archelaus was nothing but cunning, and tricked Perdiccas' brother Alcetus. Yes, the former usurper Alcetus, who is somehow alive, and his son, both of whom presumably were the rightful heir to the throne, and had them brutally murdered. We get this narrative from Plato, who used it as a lesson in morality in his Socratic dialogue Gorgias. I'll let Plato take it from here. Translated by Benjamin Jowett. That he, Alcetus, is wicked I cannot deny, for he had no title at all to the throne which he now occupies. He being the only son of a woman who was the slave of Alcetus, the brother of Perdiccas. He himself, therefore, in strict right, was the slave of Alcetus. And if he had not meant to do rightly, he would have remained his slave. And then, according to your doctrine, he would have been happy. But now he is unspeakably miserable, for he has been guilty of the greatest crimes. In the first place, he invited his uncle and master, Alcetus, to come to him, under the pretense that he would restore him to the throne, which Perdiccas had usurped. And after entertaining him and his son Alexander, who was his own cousin and nearly of an age with him, and making them drunk, he threw them into a wagon and carried them off by night and slew them and got them out of the way. And when he had done all this wickedness, he never discovered that he was the most miserable of all men. He was very far from repenting. Shall I tell you how he showed his remorse? He had a younger brother, a child of 7 years old, who was the legitimate son of Perdiccas, and to him of right the kingdom belonged. Archelaus, however, had no mind to bring him up as he ought and restore the kingdom to him. That was not his notion of happiness. But not long afterwards he threw him into a well and drowned him, and declared to his mother Cleopatra that he had fallen in while running after a goose and had been killed. And now, as he is the greatest criminal of all Macedonians, he may be supposed to be the most miserable and not the happiest of them. And I dare say that there are many Athenians, and you would be at the head of them, who'd rather be any Macedonian than Archelaus. I honestly don't think that Archelaus was the son of a slave, or the bastard son of Perdiccas. It sounds like slander by slighted royals hoping for a shot at the throne, or maybe some Greek embellishment that fit in with their own prejudice against barbarians. I do think it's possible that the following happened. Archelaus, seeing what had just happened during the last succession, learned from his father's struggle that the best way towards peace and stability was not allowing your rivals the chance to challenge you. So if that means tricking them into thinking you wish to make amends, then brutally massacring them, then making sure you find your younger half-brother to drown, and finishing off by lying to your father's wife that you just murdered one of her children after so recently losing a husband, then that's the price of stability. Oh, and by the way, what better way to seal the deal for your legitimacy than to marry your father's wife? She's not your biological mother, after all. And then have a child with her to replace the one you just murdered. Yes, Archelaus married his father's wife, Cleopatra. And they'll have a son together, named Orestes. You just can't make this stuff up. Regardless of how he came to power, our friend Thucydides seems to think that Archelaus was alright, especially when compared to a betrayal of his father. Unfortunately, we are near the end of the Peloponnesian War, so Thucydides doesn't provide us with any details on his reign. All we have is a mention of Archelaus in passing. The passage in question refers to the last time when Sitocles and the Thracians invaded Macedonia, and the Macedonians take refuge in their fortified cities. Thucydides is clearly writing at some point after Archelaus' reign. The Landmark translation, quote, "The Macedonians, unable to take the field against so numerous an invader, shut themselves up in such strong places and fortresses as the country possessed. Of these, there were no great number, most of those now found in the country having been erected subsequently by Archelaus, son of Perdiccas, on his accession, who also cut straight roads, and otherwise put the kingdom on better footing as regards to horses, heavy infantry, and other war material than had been done by all the eight kings that preceded him. Archelaus is actually known for making a number of memorable changes to Macedonia, which I'll get to in a bit. Philip II and Alexander the Great get a lot of credit for how they reformed the Macedonian military, but some historians believe many of the ideas they implemented were initially instituted by Archelaus, and then were lost in the intervening chaos that followed his reign until Philip's time. I'll talk about this more when I do an episode on the military reforms of Philip. During Archelaus' reign, Athens' decline in power is also apparent, pointing to a new state of Spartan dominance in the Greek world which pervaded after the end of the Peloponnesian War in 404 BC. Archelaus continued to supply Athens with timber, providing him with the necessary treasure that creating new roads to connect his kingdom and fortifying strategic points would no doubt cost. It was a time of unprecedented closeness with Athens. The important Macedonian port of Pydna briefly regained its independence at some point, and in 410, the Greeks helped Archelaus bring it back into the fold. In order to prevent something like this happening again, Archelaus refounded it as a Macedonian settlement 4 kilometers inland, probably with some Macedonian settlers, and in a position that could more easily be taken by land which the Macedonians surrounded, versus having the capability of holding out by being resupplied by sea. At this point, there had to be a waterway that would allow ships to travel upstream to Pydna, because to my knowledge it was still used to access the Thermaic Gulf. Can you imagine that? Relocating an entire town 4 kilometers inward, because that's what the king said would happen. And after you just lost your city, and had it at least partially sacked, not nearly as horrifying as this experience must have been for the people involved then, it reminds me of a time when I was in the army working on battalion staff. And just a forewarning, whenever I read history, I try really hard to make some sort of analogous comparison to experiences in my own life, or at least something closer to modern times. In no way do I think my experience comes to a fraction of the suffering of the people of Pydna. Disclaimer made, back to the story. So we were doing a training exercise at the National Training Center in the Mojave Desert. As part of the operation, we had to set up a tactical operations center, which is essentially a headquarters of interlocking tents with a ton of communication and technical equipment. So in full body armor, in the middle of the day, in the Mojave Desert, in July, we set this bad boy up. It took us close to an hour. Right when the last chair was unfolded, the battalion commander arrived on the scene. He called our operations officer, a major, over to where he was and whispered in his ear. And next thing you know, we had to disassemble and reassemble the entire talk just 400 meters uphill. Now, much like Archelaus, he had absolutely had a good reason for doing this, but it always hurts the most to get kicked when you're already down. So maybe that story wasn't that close of a connection to the actual one, but I thought it was still semi-relevant. Anyways, Archelaus' friendship with the Athenians continued, and around 407, the Athenians honored Archelaus for allowing them to build ships at a dedicated shipyard in Macedonia, right at the source of the timber Macedon was providing the Athenians. The king of Macedon didn't share his love for the Greeks only with the Athenians, but also with the Thessalians. Around 400, the Thessalian city of Larissa's oligarchs were at odds with a moderate faction in the city of Aleut. Aristippus, the oligarch's leader, appealed to Archelaus for help, which Archelaus promptly provided, putting Aristippus in power and garrisoning the city with Macedonians. Archelaus then made sure he took some border territory that controlled the roads leading into Macedonia, and took some hostages in the process. This was, of course, for the city of Larissa's protection. And the experience of Pydna and Larissa points to the effect that Archelaus' reforms must have had on the Macedonian ability to project power. They were able to easily take a fortified coastal town of Pydna, with Athenian help of course, and for the first time since Alexander, look beyond the purview of Macedonia to engage in neighboring kingdoms and pull laissez faire. For example, when Archelaus cut straight roads through his kingdom, he enabled himself the ability to rapidly deploy his military forces across his territory into neighboring territory. This no doubt aided in communication and also made it easier to send soldiers quickly into places like Upper Macedon. I also imagine that by being able to redeploy your soldiers around the country quickly, you can manage to leave a smaller garrison at home when you go campaigning. This, to me, is analogous to the interior lines that countries in World War I had established. Long railway systems that connected the country and enabled quick deployments from one part of the kingdom to the other. Add that to the fact that Archelaus is fortifying key points of the kingdom, it means that he is overall less afraid of a surprise invasion. This doesn't mean he didn't face difficulties. Supposedly, there's another war against the Lycestians, remember Lycus? Where Arrhabaeus and his son caused serious concern for the Macedonians. Overall, though, his position is vastly more secure compared to his father, and no doubt in large part due to his reforms. Now, Archelaus made another momentous decision. He decided to move the capital city of his kingdom, or more accurately, his seat of power. Leading up to Archelaus' reign, Macedonian kings had ruled from their ancestral home of Aiga, which today is near the Greek city of Virginia. Aiga, as you'd suspect of the ancestral home of the Macedonians, was based on the north side of Mount Olympus, near the Aleikman River, on a hillside overlooking the Thermaic Plain with a breathtaking view. Today it is a UNESCO Heritage World Cultural Monument. Aiga, after the move, maintained its role as the second royal residence and the location of all religious ceremonies and royal burials. We know this not just because of the records, which tell us this, but also because archaeologists have excavated what is believed to be Philip II's tomb in the 1970s, a monumental find for ancient Macedon history. The best part is, they're pretty sure it's Philip, because the injuries to the body that was buried there includes evidence of a missing eye, a story for another day, and other infamous injuries Philip bore. And where did Archelaus and all his hubris move the capital to? Well, Pella, of course. Archelaus' move is a positive example of how breaking with tradition can be a very good thing. Pella was located in the central of the Macedonian plain, and it controlled the major thoroughfare running from east to Byzantium, all the way west to the Adriatic. During Roman times, this thoroughfare became known as the all-important Via Ignatia. It also had the benefit of being located near a strategic crossing at the Axios River, no doubt top of Archelaus' mind, as the area had so recently provided the Thracians with a bountiful launch point into the rest of Macedon. This crossing not only connects east and west, but also intersected with a major north-to-south thoroughfare that connected the Baltic interior with the North Aegean. Beyond geography, Pella in ancient times was located on a lake, which has since gone dry, and a river from the lake allowed ships to travel up from the Thermaic Gulf. It also had a rich hinterland that could be farmed to support a large population, and in almost Roman fashion, it had a street plan, a feature that few prominent ancient cities had had the foresight to benefit from. You have to think Archelaus loves moving and founding whole new cities from scratch, and would have enjoyed the computer game SimCity in our modern times. And he would have been damn good at it too, because within a generation, Pella was acknowledged as the greatest Macedonian city by both size and commercial output. Now, all of these improvements had to have been exorbitantly expensive. I'm sure Athens' massive shipbuilding and timber buying spree helped Archelaus out a lot. I'm also positive that after an entire generation of intermittent warfare from his father, the amount of extra revenue that came from peace was substantial. And there has to have been a major economic windfall from establishing better roads that encouraged trade, from fortifying and garrisoning key points in the kingdom, which made tax collection easier and more effective, and from maintaining a peaceful relationship with your neighbors that allows goods to cross borders. He also managed to stifle the currency decline from his father, minting a slightly less debased version of the coins Alexander I minted. In keeping with Grandpa Alexander, Archelaus also took his historic mission of fostering Greek culture and portraying his court as Greek at heart. He hired Euripides in the early 400s BC to write plays for Macedon, to include the play Archelaus, a play on the founder of the Argead royal house. For some reason, Euripides changes the name of the hero of this story from Perdiccas to Archelaus. He sponsored many Greek artists, as well as games. He was supposed to have participated in one of the chariot races at the Olympics. He was determined to continue the work of Hellenizing Macedonian nobles. This didn't mean that Greeks didn't view him as a barbarian, but it continues to lay the groundwork that Philip II and Alexander the Great will capitalize on. Unfortunately, as this so often happens in history, the good times have to come to an end at some point. Archelaus was murdered in 399 on a hunting trip. Seriously, Robert Baratheon, people. There's conflicting accounts of both circumstance and motivation. Some sources say it was political, others personal. The most common story I find is the one I like the best, which is that he was killed out of revenge by a spurned male lover. Diodorus Siculus gives us an account of multiple accomplices being involved. This is Diodorus Siculus translated by Alfred Bradford, Quote, in 399 BC, King Archelaus lost his life when he was, quote, accidentally, end quote, struck by his lover, Craterus, during a hunt. Such, quote, assassinations, end quote, often occur because of the concupiscence of some monarch, as was the case with Archelaus and Craterus. As an aside, concupiscence means strong sexual desire or lust. Craterus never forgot the outrage, and needed only the least excuse to hate him. In this case, that the king had promised him one of his daughters and didn't give him one, though the true case was that Craterus could not bear the love affair. Likewise, Helenocrates, the Laurisan, joined the plot. He had been violated in his youth, and as he had not gotten what he had been promised, he considered the incident not to be love but rape. And Decamincnes, too, was the leader of the assignation of Archelaus, because of his anger over an incident in which Archelaus had allowed Euripides, the poet, to have him whipped. Euripides had become angry when Decamincnes told him he had bad breath. End quote. I just want to point out that for ancient peoples, or at the very least for ancient rulers and military men, the question of sexuality was much more fluid than we think of it today, and probably would not fit neatly into our views of hetero versus homosexuality. In parts of Greece, it was more important to be the dominant party in an encounter. Many of us are familiar with the Theban cavalry, a sacred band that was allegedly a band of male lovers. We also know that Macedonians aren't alone in the abuse of young boys. In this case, these men could have come from the Macedonian royal pages, by the way. There are recorded incidents among the Spartans of sponsoring young boys and engaging in sexual acts with them. I only point these examples out because Archelaus is not an exception in his sexual relationships with boys and men, and I'm not sure if he was intended to be portrayed as a supposed morality tale on the perils of homosexual love with boys. It was no doubt a common practice. This incident, by the way, has some foreshadowing. Philip II is himself, spoiler, assassinated and runs into similar trouble from a once-time male lover. Archelaus ruled for 14 glorious and relatively peaceful years. Despite potentially ignominious beginnings, during his reign he was a successful ruler. He made important reforms and updates to his administration of his land and military. He established Pella as the capital of Macedon, allowing future Macedonian kings to project their power across all of Macedonia. He maintained friendly relations with his neighbors, and especially with Athens. If he had lived longer, he might have been what Philip II would become a generation later. But he didn't, and this is where I ding Archelaus, and that is he didn't properly secure his succession. It's always a mistake for a king to plan on living to a ripe old age. It seems to me that it's far more likely that a king is cut down in their prime more often than they die in peace. And so before Archelaus was assassinated, he probably thought he had his house in order for his eventual descent from the throne. He had a son by his wife, Cleopatra, Orestes, who was his designated successor, as well as two other sons and a daughter. He married off his daughter to Amyntas II, another grandson of Alexander I from the Menelaus line, as a way to secure loyalty and prevent succession struggles. Unfortunately for Orestes, when he took power, he was at the tender age of 4 years old. So Orepos, who is Archelaus' half-brother and Orestes' uncle, was named regent. And this is the point when the storm hits Category 5 level. It's so confusing, you have to have a family tree in front of you to understand what the heck is going on. What's even more confusing is I have four secondary sources I'm relying on, and the primary sources as well, and all of them display this tree differently, and omit or add certain players depending on what interpretation they hold to be true. So let me try and simplify this for you. I'm going to post my version of the family tree I'll be working with on our webpage, empirehistorypodcast.com. But here's how I want you to think about it. Alexander I had five sons, Perdiccas II, Menelaus, Amyntas, Philip I, and Alcetus. We no longer have to worry about Philip I or Alcetus. Perdiccas and the Thracians took care of Philip I and his son Amyntas, so that line is dead. Archelaus was nice enough to brutally murder Alcetus and his son Alexander, so they're dead. It turns out usurpation is extremely hazardous to your health. That leaves Perdiccas II, Menelaus, and the Amyntas lines left. Perdiccas II's line is about to depart from history when Orepus dies from an illness in 4 years. So in these succession struggles, all you have to worry about is the Amyntas I line and Menelaus. Because Menelaus has a son who's named Amyntas II, and Amyntas the First has a grandson named Amyntas the Third, this is still extremely confusing. If this helps you, I've decided to associate these three brothers with three sons of the Godfather. If you haven't seen The Godfather Part 1 and 2, take this as a call to action and get out there and educate yourself. So Alexander's sons, the three we care about. Think about Perdiccas II's line as sunny. His line is bold, but burns out quickly in a fiery glory. Menelaus, on the other hand, is like Fredo. He takes a shot at power, does a pretty mucked up job at it, and has to be taken out by Amyntas, our main protagonist and Michael of the story. Like Michael, Amyntas, really his descendants, build a mob empire, the likes of which have never been seen through cunning and violence. If this doesn't help, don't worry, I'll do my best to make things clear as I go. I also want to reiterate at this point that I am just sharing with you one version of the story, the one I think most probable and convincing. So back to Orestes, son of Archelaus, who was the son of Perdiccas, or Sunny in this story, is a child when he takes the throne in 399. As is so common with child kings, his uncle Arepos takes over as regent at this time to oversee the realm until he comes of age. In 397, Orestes disappears from the records. Some sources claim he was murdered by Arepos, and I think it's probably pretty likely he was. Arepos, though, only reigned as king for 6 years, because at this point he died of an unknown disease. We don't know much about his reign because we don't have a Thucydides or Herodotus to help us. Now it's time for the Menelaus line, or Fredo, to make their entrance. Amyntas II seized power upon Arepos' death. Now Arepos had a son Pausanias, but it seems like he was ejected from power before he could take control. Amyntas II is also called Amyntas the Little. It's unknown if he was a little person, but if so, maybe he's the Tyrian of the Argead dynasty. The Fredo line is not long for this world, and Amyntas the Little was killed violently within 3 months. His quick assassination can be attributed to the lack of legitimacy that comes with the usurper. The line is not completely removed, though. Amyntas the Little had a son, Ptolemy, who we'll have cause to deal with later. With Amyntas the Little, or the Second, out of the picture, Pausanias, son of Arepos, who was the son of Perdiccas, remember, took power, but is quickly murdered by Amyntas the Third, who is the grandson of Amyntas the First, our Michael of the story. This is the last we hear of the Perdiccas' line. Like Sonny and the Godfather, their reign was bright, brash, and glorious, but short-lived in the subsequent struggle for power. It should be noted that all kings following Archelaus minted coins in their names in a way that copied Archelaus, except that with each successive king, the coin was debased a little more and made more worthless. We can interpret this as trying to harness some of the legitimacy from Archelaus' rule by associating it with their own through their coinage. If you're confused at this point, that's fine. I'll post the family tree, and I'm doing this to be thorough. So Amyntas III took power in 393. His line will hold power consistently, with one exception from 393 through the dark times to Philip II in 359. This time is not a peaceful or stable time, in spite of this consistency, and despite Amyntas ruling for 23 years. Macedonians' internal struggles left them weak, while their neighbors grew strong. To the west, Amyntas III faced the ascendant Illyrians led by Bardolus. Bardolus is a super interesting character. He was born in 448 to a charcoal burner and a coal miner. He proved to be a great warrior and leader. And when he took power, he consolidated it across the different Illyrian tribes to create a strong, burgeoning kingdom. By 393, Bardolus has had plenty of time to consolidate power and take advantage of Macedonians' weakness. What's incredible is Bardolus will live until, spoiler, he is killed in battle against Philip II in 358 BC. That means he lives for an amazing 90 years, much of that time as a successful ruler. We'll be seeing him around for a while yet. So in 393, Bardolus took his army and invaded Macedonia, which forced Amyntas to flee from Macedonian exile. In some sources, the Illyrians install a figurehead ruler at this point. If this is the case, Amyntas III returned to power within 2 years after the invasion, with Thessalian help. His inability to take his own kingdom on his own terms is indicative of Macedonian weakness. There's possibly a second invasion of Illyrians in 383, where a similar course of events unfold, but the source material isn't reliable, and I actually think it's unlikely. Besides the fact that the two accounts are almost identical, I think it's unlikely because Amyntas III pulls a classic Macedonian move and secures his western flank by marrying Eurydice. Marrying Eurydice has two purposes. One, She's the granddaughter of Arrhabaeus, that king in Upper Macedonian land of Lycus, the troublesome kingdom that was no doubt the highway that the Illyrians took for their invasion. And she was also the daughter of Cyrus, who was an Illyrian ally of Lycus. This marriage had to have occurred by 391 BC because his eldest son, Alexander II, had to have been old enough to be the co-signer of a treaty with Athens in 373. With this marriage, Amyntas III is able to subdue the Illyrians for some time. Besides the Illyrians are the Chalcidians. Remember the time when Perdiccas II encouraged the Chalcidians to band together and relocate themselves under a centralized identity based in Olynthus in order to withstand the Athenian encroachment? Oh yeah, and remember when I said that this would come to haunt the Macedonians in the future? Well, that time has come. The chickens have come home to roost. In 393, the Chalcidic League was a full-formed federal organization of city-states in the Chalcidice Peninsula. Olynthus is the ruling city, and so you'll hear me use Olynthians and Chalcidians synonymously. So the Olynthians, who are now a powerful regional player, forced Amyntas to cede to them rich frontier land along their mutual border. It's possible he gave these lands up willingly to prevent them from falling into Illyrian hands. Chalcidice was also granted preferential status for all Macedonian timber and pitch, essentially a first claim over any other states that might want to purchase these resources on better terms. As time went on, it appears the Chalcidians monopolized the timber and pitch coming from Macedonia, as they were allowed to resell it as they saw fit, so long as they told the Macedonian king after the fact. The Chalcidian hunger for power is reflected in their growing desire to be a prominent naval power. Direct access to Macedonian timber and pitch allowed them to rapidly expand their fleet under favorable terms. Finally, Amyntas III and the Chalcidians agreed not to make a separate peace with any other Chalcidian enemies in the region. Meanwhile, in Greater Greece, the Corinthian War ends in 387, a war between Sparta and a coalition of Greek states to include Thebes, Athens, Corinth, Argos, and Chalcidia loosely. Chalcidians, with this peace, felt more comfortable flexing their muscles, and took more land both to the east into Thrace and further into Macedon in the west. By around 383, Amyntas III began to chafe under his Chalcidian, quote, friendship, so Amyntas III demanded that the Olynthians give him back the borderlands he had ceded them a decade prior and to cease encroachment on his lands. He may have felt emboldened to do this because of the supposed failed Illyrian invasion, if there was a second one that had happened around this time. But it was also probably him realizing that Olynthian encroachment was an existential threat. So Amyntas demands his land back, and the Olynthians, of course, protested. How was it possible to give back what was a gift to them? It's not like they had gone out and conquered it. Amyntas decided he had to retake this land by force and declared war on them, asking Sparta to join him. It's around this time that the Chalcidians invaded and took control of most of Lower Macedonia. We know about Amyntas III's plight because Macedonia isn't the only one seeking Spartan aid. The two largest cities near Olynthus, Aconthos and Apollonia, also pled to the Spartans for aid, and we have Xenophon in his Helleneca to relate their words. This is their plea to the Spartans to intervene. The Landmark translation, quote, "Then the ambassadors came to Sparta from Acanthos and Apollonia, the two largest cities in the vicinity of Olynthus. And when the ephors heard why they had come, they brought them into the assembly of the Spartans and their allies." Just so you know, ephors were five Spartan magistrates who shared power with the two Spartan kings. Also, it's very possible that a Macedonian envoy is among the allies, also urging intervention. There, Clytemnestra of Acanthos addressed them. "Men of Sparta and her allies, we think that a great danger is growing in Hellas, one which you are not yet aware of. Nearly all of you know, of course, that Olynthus is the great city of all those in the Thrace. Now these Olynthians have won over some of the largest cities in the region. After this, they even tried to liberate some of the cities of Macedon from the ruler Amyntas, the Macedonian king. And when the Macedonian cities nearest Olynthus did not go over to their side, the Olynthians swiftly marched against other cities that were farther away and larger. When we left, they were already holding many other cities, especially Pella, which is the greatest of all Macedonian cities. We learned, too, that Amyntas had withdrawn from his cities and was already all but expelled from Macedon. Moreover, the Olynthians sent to us and to the people of Apollonia, telling us that unless we present ourselves to campaign together with them, then they would march against us." Now, I'm going to read to you the rest of this passage because I think it feeds into the fears and motivations of why the Spartans decide to ultimately march against the Olynthians. So back to it. "But we, men of Sparta, wish to follow our ancestral laws and to be an independent city. If, however, someone does not come to our assistance, we too will have to join the Olynthian side. And yet they now have more than 800 hoplites and even more peltasts. And their cavalry, if we join them, will number more than 1,000. When we left there, were also Athenian and Boeotian ambassadors present. We were told that the Olynthians had already voted to send their ambassadors to Athens and Thebes to discuss an alliance. Now, if Olynthians' forces are to be addressed to those of the Athenians and Boeotians, you should be aware that it will no longer be easy to deal with them. Keep in mind, this is the time of Spartan hegemony. You must realize that, because they hold Potidaea, which is on the isthmus of Pallene, the cities farther down the peninsula will have to be subject to them. And although these cities hate the Olynthians, nevertheless they do not dare send ambassadors with us who would inform you about the state of affairs there. And you should interpret all absence as yet another piece of evidence that these cities are in utmost fear. Consider this too. How is it reasonable for you to take great care to prevent Boeotia from uniting, and yet ignore a much greater power that is being consolidated, one that is beginning to be strong, not only by land but also by sea? For what stands in their way? They have good timber in their lands for building ships, revenues from many harbors and trading posts, and an abundant food supply that supports a large population. And then, one should also consider their neighbors. Those Thracians that are not ruled by a king, who have for a long time now been paying court to the Olynthians. Indeed, if the Thracians were to follow the Olynthians' lead, the Olynthians would immediately stretch their hand to the gold mines at Mount Pangaeon, a lucrative mountain to the east of the Chalcedes in Thrace. And we are not saying anything here that has not already been discussed 1,000 times by the Olynthian people. And how would one then describe the Olynthians' haughtiness? God, I suppose, ordained it such that as people's powers increases, so does their pride. So then, men of Sparta and allied states, we have informed you of how matters stand here. Discuss these affairs if they seem to you to be worthy of your concern. But you must know this also, that the Olynthians' power, although great, is not yet one that is difficult to wrestle with, because those cities that now against their will have a common citizen with Olynthians will swiftly revolt from them if they see a substantial power standing up to them. If, however, over time they become joined by rites of intermarriage and property among themselves, things that they have already voted for, and if they realize that they may profit from following the conqueror, then perhaps it will no longer be so easy for you to dissolve their union. The ambassadors from this passage are incurring for Sparta to launch the equivalent of a preemptive strike. Spartans, who are currently the hegemon of Greece, have an interest in maintaining their power, and it's a compelling argument to stifle the competition before they become too powerful. The Spartans decide to accept this argument, and in 382, sent 10,000 troops to link up with an advanced force. To help pave the way, the Spartan general Tolotius recommended to Ambantus that if he wants to recover his kingdom, he should hire mercenaries and give money to the neighboring kings so that they would become his allies. The Spartans also had a separate alliance with an Upper Macedonian ruler named Derdis, who with his 400 cavalry from Upper Macedon were credited with helping in the first Spartan victory against the Olynthians. I bring it up because it's a sign of just how weak Amyntas is, that an Upper Macedonian ally is more valued than he is, because there is no reference of him at all at this point. The Olynthian War raged until Sparta took Olynthus in the fall of 379, at which point the Spartans hailed victory. This resulted in the dissolution of the Chalcedian Confederacy, and Amyntas not only regained his kingdom, presumably early on in the conflict, but also took back many of the lands that had been gifted to the Olynthians. For the Spartans, it turned out to be a bittersweet victory. The campaign cost lives and treasure, including the lives of General Tolutius and a Spartan king. It also was a reputational blow to the Spartans because they tore down a group of Greek city-states, in part for the benefit of absolute monarchy. In all, the situation turned out well for Amyntas. He was able to regain his throne, and now had his west secured through marriage and his east secured by conflict. And Amyntas didn't just benefit from his relationship with the Spartans. He also stayed engaged with Athens. At some point, he adopted the great Athenian general Iphicrates. Iphicrates had fought in the Corinthian War, which took place from 395 and ended in 387, right before Amyntas III's reign began. He's best known for his innovation in improving peltasts, which are lightly infantry soldiers who he armed with a small shield, a sword, and a spear. I'll talk about military tactics in another episode. But his peltasts proved very effective against the traditional Spartan hoplite. Anyway, after the war, the general spent some time north of his... Anyway, after the war, the general spent some time north of his homeland, near the lands of Thrace, and married the Thracian king's Cotys I's daughter around 386. Iphicrates stayed in Thrace and worked with Cotys, training his forces. Amyntas adopted Iphicrates as his son in hopes of gaining control of some Thracian mercenaries. It also helped secure ties with Athens. But I really bring up Iphicrates now, because he is going to help Amyntas' successors in Macedonia survive the still tumultuous years ahead. In 375 BC, Athens and Amyntas signed a trade deal to secure timber for a new Athenian fleet, with revenues generated funding Amyntas' army to keep him on the throne. At this point, Athens was building a massive new navy in an attempt to regain their place of power in the peninsula. But of course, the Athenians didn't just want lumber from Macedonia. They also wanted our old, beloved, and still independent city, Amphipolis. Macedonian policy in recent years had been one of neutrality regarding the matter. Amyntas, no doubt wanting to please the Athenians, agreed to this, however, in 371, when the Spartans called a Congress of Greeks, who voted in favor of the Athenian claim on Amphipolis. What's incredible about this act is it's the first time we have any recording of Macedonian contributing to such a pan-Greek council. It points to an increasing level of integration between Macedonia and the Hellenic world. Two more major events happened in 371. The Boeotians, or Thebans, to the Greek world's surprise, crushed the Spartans at the Battle of Leuctra, ending Spartan hegemony and marking the period of Theban dominance. Epaminondas was the general who led this victory for Thebes, and he will have a momentous impact on Philip's education when Philip is taken as a Theban hostage during his youth. Also in 371, Thessaly, which remember is directly to Macedonia's south, elected Jason the Phare to the Tagos of Thessaly. The Tagos was an elected position that is rarely given, and it bestows overall authority and supreme command of all Thessalians. Jason and Amyntas signed an alliance, where Amyntas gave Jason timber supplies in exchange for a secure southern border. Some historians interpret this as an impressed alliance where Amyntas only remained nominal control of Macedonia, and the Thessalians occupied the borderlands. Amyntas passed away the next year in 370. And this brings me to Amyntas III's legacy. Was he a good king? According to ancient sources, he was a competent general and an energetic ruler. He managed to secure his kingdom to the west through marriage of the Illyrians, and the east with the help of Sparta. Like Perdiccas II, seems like he was dealt a pretty bad hand. But there's also the saying, the proof is in the pudding. And the pudding that comes out of his reign is more toxic sludge than pudding. Over the course of his reign, the coinage of Macedonia continued to be debased from Archelaus' time, and his inability to secure power for his children led to many of their premature deaths. The realm is far from the road to recovery. Maybe during a better time he would have been a great ruler, but without more nuance about his reign from sources like Thucydides or Herodotus, which we don't have for him, there's just not enough information to excuse his failures and name him as a great ruler. Speaking of children and being great at something, unfortunately for our narrative, Amyntas III was great at having children. He has 7 children between 2 wives, with Eurydice, who has part Illyrian and part Lycus. He has Alexander II, Perdiccas III, Philip II, and a daughter Eurino. It should be noted that all of these sons will take the Macedonian throne and rule at some point. Through Gygaea, who was an Argead, he had Archelaus, Eridaeus, and Menelaus. At this point, let's just put Gygaea's side out of your mind. It's not important or relevant. Now, before I transition to post-Amyntas III's reign, I also want to bring up some drama I left out previously. Drama which could just be a familiar trope that probably had no truth, but makes for a good story. While Amyntas was still alive, Eurydice's daughter Eurino is supposed to have married Ptolemy, the last remaining male from the Menelaus line. Remember Fredo? Ptolemy was the son of Amyntas the Little. Ptolemy, though, didn't want to just be the son-in-law of the king, but apparently wanted to be the king, and reportedly took his mother-in-law Eurydice as a lover. From Alfred Bradford's translation, Amyntas's wife made an adulterous pact with the son-in-law Ptolemy, that she would kill her husband Amyntas, marry the son-in-law, and hand the kingdom over to her adulterer. Amyntas would have been caught in the plot, had his daughter not betrayed the adultery of her mother in the plots of the criminal. For whatever reason, Amyntas pardoned his wife and son-in-law for the plot, which in hindsight would prove troublesome for Amyntas III's successors. You have to imagine family dinners were incredibly awkward for Eurino after all this went down. Anyway, back to the narrative. Amyntas is dead, and Alexander II took over the crown in 370. He bought peace with the Illyrians. Apparently having a partially Illyrian mother is no longer enough. And although some sources say Philip II was given as a hostage, which was common for securing peace, it seems unlikely because Philip would be given as a hostage to Thebes very shortly. Having secured peace with Illyria, Alexander allied himself with Thessalian aristocratic refugees, who were exiles of Jason the Tagos, and in a betrayal with his father's treaty, marched on the city of Larissa, which is, remember, close to Macedon, and then Crannon in central Thessaly, taking both without warning. Instead of doing the prudent thing and returning these cities over to a friendly Thessalian faction, he instead decided to betray them as well and kept the cities for himself. Why he thought this was a good idea is beyond me. The Thessalians turned to Thebes, who was the new big kid on the block. In 368, Thebes obliged by sending the distinguished general Pelopidas with an army to retake the cities. The Macedonians quickly handed back the cities when faced with an enemy army. The Theban army was then invited oh so graciously into Macedonia by Alexander II and our adulterous friend Ptolemy, who was trying to angle his way into power once again. Pelopidas offered to mediate the dispute, but ended up keeping Alexander II on the throne with new guarantees made from the Macedonian king on their behavior. Pelopidas took 30 royal hostages with him to guarantee the peace, including Philip II. It seems like the Thebans didn't take any further retribution against the Macedonians because they were afraid of an unchallenged and strong Thessaly. Ptolemy, of course, wasn't about to give up power that easily and assassinate Alexander II later that year. It's at this point that the story about Ptolemy and Eurydice could have been made up and circulated by those upset with this turn of events. For legitimacy, Ptolemy pointed to Alexander II's failed campaign in Thessaly and installed himself merely as a regent of his brother-in-law Perdiccas III, who was not old enough to rule in his own right. He also potentially married Eurydice, which could have been evidence of her guilt or merely a way for her to secure the safety of her children. Regardless, upon Alexander II's death, Ptolemy was faced with the challenge to his rule by a usurper named Pausanias. We don't know where he comes from. He was probably from another branch of the Argead dynasty that we don't know about. Pausanias took some major cities in the southeast part of Macedon and had wide support in some parts of the kingdom. It's at this point that Eurydice appeals to her adopted son and Greek general Iphicrates to help protect his younger adopted brother Philip II and Perdiccas III. She, of course, left out any mention of Ptolemy. From the usurper Pausanias, Iphicrates, who was in the area, agreed to eliminate Pausanias after he was given renewed assurances from Ptolemy that they would aid him in taking Amphipolis for the Athenians. Unfortunately for Iphicrates, the next year, in 367, the Theban general Pelopidas will have to deal with a conflict in Thessaly again. And while he was up there, he was invited by Ptolemy's enemies to come to Macedon and remove him from the throne. Ptolemy quickly switched sides and bribed Pelopidas, as well as offered to supply Thebes, who had an interest in building a strong navy now as well, with timber. Pelopidas recognized Ptolemy as regent in kind, took some more Macedonian hostages to include Ptolemy's son for good measure, and Iphicrates was recalled to Athens with nothing to show for his efforts. Now, presumably, Iphicrates took care of Pausanias before this happened. Ptolemy ruled for another 2 years as regent until 365. But you see, Ptolemy did not learn the lessons Archelaus laid out, that in order to maintain power, sometimes you have to be decisive and brutal. This is especially true if you aim to keep reigning past a regency, even more so when you murdered the previous king, who was also your ward's brother. As Perdiccas III reached the age to start ruling, he had no plans to keep Ptolemy around. In 365, he had Ptolemy killed, and he took power in his own right. Unfortunately for Perdiccas, things went south real fast, and it wasn't for lack of trying to be a good king. Perdiccas surrounded himself and filled his court with great Greek thinkers of the day. He worked with a prominent Athenian exile to double Macedonian harbor dues. He cultivated ties with great philosophers like Plato and Euphrates. On a quick note, supposedly when Euphrates joined Perdiccas' court and became the king's royal advisor, he made a point of forbidding the king's companions of joining the common mess unless they knew geometry or philosophy. Yes, I suppose he was that type of guy. Overall, Perdiccas III was relying on a tried-and-true policy of portraying his court as Greek while having the benefit of collecting competent advisors. He also solidified a tradition of having prominent Greeks educate the children of the kingdom's elites, which would play a crucial role in Alexander the Great's upbringing. Perdiccas even succeeded in having his younger brother Philip return to him from Thebes. He promptly gave Philip some territory to rule on his own on a frontier of the Anphaxis region, or the region that bordered the Axios River. But life outside the capital was not so rosy. Let's start with Athens. At first, things between Perdiccas III and Athens started off well. But in 362, he sided with Amphipolis against Athens' attempt to retake the city, installing a garrison there and foiling the Athenians. The Athenian general, failing to take the city, made a truce with Perdiccas, resulting in Athens recalling him and putting him to death. His successor captured the port of Pydna and Methone in retribution and tried, yet again, to take Amphipolis but was repelled by the Macedonian garrison. Perdiccas had to also deal with the Illyrians. In 360, the Illyrian threat was great, and Perdiccas went out to meet the Illyrians, potentially with our old friend Bartolus, in battle with a large force of Macedonians. The battle ended with Perdiccas dead and seemingly astounding number of casualties from the Macedonian side, 4,000 dead in all. And this set up Macedonia for its most existential threat in its history. Unfriendly Athenians were along the coastline and at the sea. An army Illyrians, fresh from victory to the west, were waiting to invade. Chalcidians were reforming to the east, and a strong Thessaly and Thebes remained to the south. It'd be understandable for a ruler to crumble under the pressure, or simply fail because of the task maintaining the kingdom was insurmountable. Luckily for Macedonians, Philip II took over for his fallen brother Perdiccas III, and he is no ordinary king. He accomplishes the impossible, not only saving his kingdom, but forging it into something closer to a modern country, with a Macedonian identity and transcendent military that will take it to new heights. And normally at this point, I'd say all this next time on Empire History Podcast. But before I start Philip's reign, I'm going to have a few episodes that sets the stage for Philip. One will be on Macedonian culture up until the time of Philip. Another will take us on a broad overview of Macedon's neighbors. I think we'd benefit learning a little bit more about, for example, the Illyrians. I also would like to do a dedicated episode on military reforms of Philip and Alexander. That may come later, though. So stay tuned. There's a lot of exciting material in the future. And as we transition to focusing on one man's reign and getting a lot more of the details, it should get that much more interesting. See you next time, and thanks for listening to Empire History Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a rate and review on iTunes. Also, if you want to connect, feel free to like our Facebook page, Empire History Podcast, or tweet to us at Empire_History. As always, I appreciate your interest in the podcast, and I'm getting a lot of great feedback that I'm trying to incorporate in the show. So thank you, and talk to you soon.